could have had TDD, but there was just no way of knowing. But I'll continue to monitor it, and it'll happen. Actually, I went out to the park a little earlier this morning, and there's a little gazebo out there. So even if it did rain, instead of going over there, we could go over there and just go in the gazebo. Let's start off. Let's resume our study of the great wisdom beyond Wisdom Heart Sutra. This time, let's chant. I have two translations. Let's do the one on page one. This is my translation. It's a little easier to understand than the more conventional one. Great wisdom beyond Wisdom Heart Sutra. The Heart Prajnaparamita Sutras. The Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, the embodiment of enlightened compassion, when practicing deeply the Prajnaparamita, the wisdom that goes beyond wisdom, perceives that we are all empty of a separate self, empty of permanent characteristics and interdependent with all things. Know then that all material forms are empty of the slightest substantial self-existence, and that luminous emptiness does not differ from material forms. That which is form is emptiness. That which is emptiness form. The same is true of conscious states, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. All are empty of independent self-existence. Also know that all structures of relativity are empty of inherent self-existence, free from characteristic marks or limits. They do not appear nor disappear, are not tainted nor pure, do not increase nor decrease. Therefore, in emptiness, no independent form, feeling, perceptions, formations, consciousness, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind, color, sound, smell, taste, touch, object of mind. No independent realm of eyes until no realm of mind consciousness. No ignorance and also no extinction of it until no old age and death, and also no extinction of old age and death. No suffering, no origin of suffering, no end of suffering and no path. No knowledge and also no attainment. With nothing to attain, a bodhisattva, a great being, depends on Prajnaparamita, and the mind is no hindrance. Without any hindrance, no fears exist. Far beyond all converted views, one realizes Nirvana. In the three worlds, all Buddhas depend on Prajnaparamita and attain unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. Therefore, know the Prajnaparamita is the great transcendent mantra, is the great bright mantra, is the unsurpassed mantra, is the incomparable mantra, which is able to relieve all suffering and is true, not false. So proclaim the Prajnaparamita mantra. Proclaim the mantra that says, Gate, Gate, Paragate, Parasamgate, Bodhisattva. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone far beyond, pure presence ever transcending, it is total awakeness, it is suchness. That last line is actually probably my favorite line. There's a translator, Lex Hudson, that I borrowed that from him. Gone, gone, gone far beyond. Gone far beyond. Pure presence ever transcending. It is total awakeness. It is suchness. I was running across a teaching the other day from Norman Fisher, and he said, just four little things. He says, presence, just keep practicing presence. This pure presence, presence. He says, if you practice pure presence, You see, you're not going to worry so much. You're not going to complain so much. And you're going to be kinder. So that's why meditation practice is so important. I mean, we can practice, of course, kindness and not worrying so much and not complaining so much, but if we find it through our meditation practice, through pure presence, so being pure present, you just naturally, the obscurations don't happen so much, and there's more an opportunity for kindness. So this sutra is really about kindness. It's about compassion, and then the natural result of compassion is kindness, which we'll talk about a little bit today. So this Sunday, I'll send you out an email, but there'll be a half-day sitting at my house. Some of you have signed up for it. We'll start about 9, sit for about half an hour, and then there'll be a Dharma talk. And then some people will leave, especially the Sunday group that I lead. Some will leave, but then some of us will continue. And there'll be a Dharma talk, a little service. And then we'll sit, 25 minutes, half an hour, do some walking, sit, walk, sit, walk. And then about 12:45, we'll probably have a little gathering where we'll just talk for a few minutes. And then people that want to have lunch. So these half-day sittings are important. As I'm going to say before, in the Tibetan tradition, they spend a lot of time actually intellectually trying to study the Heart Sutra, which is what we're doing. We're kind of, we just finished practicing the Heart Sutra. We just finished practicing pure presence. So we're practicing emptiness. We're practicing prajna. Prajna is actually how you cognize, how you experience emptiness is through your meditation practice. You can understand it by taking walks in the woods, by looking out at the river. You can understand it intellectually. You can study it, kind of like what we're doing. It helps. But the real, especially in Zen practice, we emphasize being emptiness, or being prajnaparamita. So one way to do that, of course, is primarily through our meditation practice, by actually keep coming back to pure presence, ever transcending. You know, our mind carries us off. I don't like that. I don't like that. I want that. I want that. Oh, liberate that. Back to pure presence. Back to openness. Back to expansiveness. We also practice it a lot in Zen forms, which we don't have an opportunity to do here very much. Zen forms would be like how you hand a sutra to somebody. Like we have a Tuesday morning meditation group, and I like it's a small group, about 9 people. And where you hand a sutra to somebody, you just don't hand it like this. You hand it like this. And I noticed that not only in Japan do they do that, but I noticed in Burma they were doing that too. And they hand you something, it's like with 2 hands, like here. That is a very different feeling than here. Can you feel that? One of the main things I learned from Suzuki Roshi was how he picked up a teacup. Not what he said, but like how he would pick a teacup up. It was like his hand was part of the teacup. The teacup was part of him. The tea was part of him. There was a reverential way in almost everything that he handled. And that's one way in Zen, through rituals, which you don't actually get to experience, unfortunately, but a little bit more, like when we do service or if you come to the half-day sittings. The other thing is that, you know, if you aren't trying to do a daily meditation practice, even 10 minutes a day, you're only going to get a small percentage of what I'm saying. I mean, Buddhism will help whether you sit or not. The ethics and the whole idea of interdependency. You know, clearly everybody that's interested in deep ecology understands it. Not everybody enters that through meditation practice. But if you do have a meditation practice, you will penetrate it so much more deeply. It's kind of a little bit like doing yoga. you know, if you just do yoga and the only reason you're doing it is to just kind of not stress yourself out and get more centered, that'll help you. You'll be more calm and peaceful for people. But if you actually study the Patanjali Sutras, you know, from Patanjali, you're going to get it a lot more. And that's true about this. If you enter it through not only study, but reflection and through your meditation practice. The other thing is that longer sittings are helpful. Longer sittings, like half day, a day, 2 days, 7 days, seems like, wow, 7 days, I couldn't possibly do 7 days. But you can't. Anybody can do it. Because you have the support of other people. You feel the support of other people. And you know there's a part of your life that could not do this alone. But you can do it with other people. And in our tradition, we practice, like I'll say, practice and enlightenment are the same. We call it practice realization. So we're not practicing to get this thing out here called enlightenment. Just sitting is enlightenment in our tradition, even though it doesn't feel that way. It feels like, well, this is painful. This is very discursive. But dealing with that discursiveness and that discomfort is part of practice. So in our tradition, so does Zen tradition, we call practice realization. Just sitting is it. So longer periods are important. The other thing is, so we don't stress these higher states, like these jhanic states. We don't tend to stress that. In the Theravada tradition, they do stress these samadhi states. In the Rinzai tradition, they do emphasize kensho, and that's the same as these jhanic states. It's like kind of high samadhi states, very concentrated. The discursive mind has abated, and you really have an experience of what we call piti and sukha, which is joy and ease. Those are the technical terms for it. So we don't. In our tradition, we don't practice for that because then it's like, well, I don't experience that, therefore my practice isn't good. So that's a trap, right? Anything that you think out there keeps you away from being right here. This is a very important point in our tradition, in Soto tradition. So you keep coming back to whatever's happening. But given that, if you do experience those states, it's helpful. It can be helpful. Some people sit and they don't experience them. And your sitting is still extremely valuable and worthwhile. But if you do experience them, when the mind can calm down enough, it gives you actually an experiential experience of what kind of emptiness is, because you can feel this all rightness of the world, that you're in love with the world. You can't even articulate it. And if even if you have a few hints of that, which basically you all have, you've all had that, you just haven't valued enough, you haven't, you know, appreciated the depth of what you've experienced, or that you can actually create the ground where that can happen. And it's a little bit hard to experience those states unless you sit longer periods, because the mind has to have a chance to settle. Just to settle. You probably know. If you're sitting a half an hour, the first 10 minutes of your sitting is different than the last 15 minutes. If you sit a 4 day retreat like we're going to do Sunday, the last couple hours may, if you're really paying attention, may be a little more concentrated. And so imagine what that would be like after 5, 6, 7 days, you know. So I just wanted to say that. So back to the Heart Sutra. So again, I think a good way to approach the Heart Sutra is a nice metaphor again is water. So water can be clouds, it can be rain, it can be the river, it can be mist, it can be ice. It's constantly changing and transforming. You know, when the clouds let go and become rain, the cloud doesn't get disappointed, right? When the rain evaporates into mist, into the air, it isn't disappointed. When waves break on the beach and become the ocean, the wave doesn't get disappointed. So that's a good metaphor for us as we go through having a sense of change. Another way I was just, when I walked in today, there were these puddles. And you had to kind of walk. I think I was saying to Richard, the moat, we're going through this moat. You know, so one way is I could get really irritated at that. Like, you know, slow traffic, my feet are getting wet, too much rain, there's flooding, my roof leaks. So that, on the relative level, that's the way we operate a lot. What the Heart Sutra and what your spiritual practice is not to ignore that, to deal with it, but it gives you a much bigger perspective. You begin to see how incredibly important rain is. How essential rain is. I know you all know this, so that's why I'm using that. But your mind tends to take it to a bigger level. So when somebody is irritating you, you're not focusing only on the irritation and getting that to change in that person, right? You're seeing that person in a much bigger context. You're seeing that person as maybe having a certain conditioning that doesn't have, is causing them some suffering, and you basically relate to them more in their Buddha nature. You know, that's the way the Dalai Lama relates to people. He doesn't see their what's wrong with them. He sees their potential. And that's a very different way about how we look at things. You know? And so the Heart Sutra is helping us move. Did I bring that book? I did. I was going to maybe read this at the end, but maybe there are two stories here. A stranger walked toward the gates of a new city. By the side of the road sat an old man, an old wise woman. Well, hail the traveler. Welcome. What kind of people are they who live here? The traveler asked. How did you find them in the home city you left? Asked the wise woman. They were gossips, mean-spirited, often selfish, difficult to get along with. You'll find the people in this city to be likewise. Later, a second traveler passed by and was welcomed by an old woman. What kind of people are they who live here? The second traveler asked. How did you find them in your home city? They were fine people, industrious, open-minded, and easy to get along with. You'll find the people in this city to be likewise. Here's another good story. So we're talking about the absolute. The Heart Sutra puts you into the absolute, but it translates. This is how it translates in our life. During my second month of nursing school, our professor gave us a pop quiz. I was a conscientious student and I had breezed through the questions until I read the last one. What is the first name of the woman who cleans the school? Surely this was some kind of joke. I had seen the cleaning woman many times. She was tall, dark-haired, a woman in her 50s. But how was I to know her name? I handed in my paper, leaving the last question blank. Before the class ended, one student asked if the last question... This is a true story. One student asked if the last question would count towards our quiz grade. Absolutely, said the professor. In your careers, you will meet many people. All are significant. They deserve your attention and care, even if all you do is smile and say hello. I have never forgotten that lesson. I also learned her name, Dorothy. It's a very beautiful story. There's a story of the Dalai Lama. He was lecturing in the United States, and it was a series, like he often does, four or five teachings at this hotel. And the first day he came down, and you know, people, have you ever been to one of his events? You know, people are kind of huddled. I got the chance to take care of him in his first visit before he became famous. So, I mean, too famous, right? I actually got to hang out with him, you know, which was interesting. Did I ever tell you that story? I'm walking him through. I'm the director at Ringo, so I'm taking him through, showing him all our, you know, what the kitchen's like and the zendos and the little altars and, you know, and he's going, you know, very nice. But then he goes into the kitchen, which is a little funky. It was a converted garage. And he goes over and he walks over to this cabinet, which is broken. It's off its hinge. And he must have spent 10 minutes at this cabinet trying to fix it. Sam kicks the door on his cabinet, and I'm getting like, ugh. But there was something about that that was the most profound part of my journey with him. You know, I'm digressing here, but I know you like to. So, yeah, we used to have this only time, it's like at Tassara, the only time you're really warm in the winter is when you go to the hot baths. At Green Gulch, it's damp. And the only time you're warm is a sauna. And so there's sauna for the men, sauna for the women after work. So the Dalai Lama is giving like the second lecture. You know, big deal. Dalai Lama is giving a lecture in the meditation hall. And he said, I really want to apologize. He said, I was in the sauna yesterday, you know, with some of my attendants. I mean, he wasn't joking. He was really apologetic. He says, and this woman came up and started banging on the door and said, it's the woman's hour! It's the woman's hour! So about 20 years later, we're having this 50th anniversary summit, and this one woman who I know says, I have a confession, I was the woman. I didn't know the Dalai Lama was in there, I just hear a bunch of men's voices, you know. I don't think that has anything to do with it, other than the Dalai Lama being so seen it from her point of view, right? Which is really what it's about. So I'll send you out an email about the city on Sunday. Avalokiteshvara. Avalokiteshvara, when practicing deeply the Prajna Paramita, perceive that all five skandhas, in our translation, it says aggregates, all five skandhas in their own being are empty and thus the safe from all suffering. So that one first line basically summarizes pretty much the 18 volumes of the Prajna Paramita and the rest of this sutra. So a bodhisattva is a great being. That's what bodhisattva means, is a great being. And in early Buddhism, it was more of a person. You were a bodhisattva before you became a Buddha. In other words, you were in prior lives, if you want to believe in reincarnation. Not necessary to believe in it, but well, it's important to realize reincarnation. If you think about it in terms of emptiness, that maybe you're just going to get reincarnated into carbon and water. That's a kind of reincarnation, right? And I'm personally okay with that. But in Tibetan tradition and other traditions, they really believe in a more, how would you say it, possibility of being reincarnated into a person or spiritual teacher like the Dalai Lama. So bodhisattva is somebody that hadn't quite become a Buddha. But then as Buddhism progressed, as it began to move into more of the Mahayana, where this sutra comes from, the bodhisattva became somebody not only identical, almost identical with the Buddha. In fact, you'll find many statues. Like in Zen centers, you'll often find a statue of Manjushri instead of Buddha. Like you go to Green Gulch, there's Manjushri is on the altar, who's the bodhisattva of wisdom. And because a bodhisattva, what a bodhisattva does is, the bodhisattva does not go into nirvana until everybody, it's like the captain on the ship, you do not leave the ship until everybody is off, you're the last one. And that's the idea. And this was a very substantial difference. Because in early Buddhism, the monks kind of withdrew from the world. The world was tainted. You went into your cave and you meditated and got real clear and attained nirvana. You know, and you helped your other monks. But as it progressed, it was more like, no, you got to help the lay people. And then the lay people got to help everybody. Everybody's helping everybody else get off the raft of suffering into less suffering. So the logical conclusion is, and this is a point that I talk with a lot of people about, this is a big step in your practice, is you realize, well, how could you possibly be enlightened unless, how could you be free of suffering unless everybody's free of suffering, right? I mean, you've got to help everybody, right? Now, of course, The trap of that is you don't want to be codependent, right? In other words, you don't want to go around with a huge amount of angst all the time, thinking that I've got to get everybody, free of suffering. But at some level, that's true. You're always working. The bodhisattva is always there. So in the Mahayana wheel, the wheel of codependent origination, down here is usually the hell realms, which represent, the greed, hate, especially the greed realms. And often you'll see a picture of a bodhisattva in the hell realms. And that's what that means, is the bodhisattva is going into the hell realms. You don't withdraw from the hell realms, you go into the hell realms. And that's also a metaphor for our own practice. We don't dissociate from those parts we don't like. We don't distance ourselves, we would say in Jungian therapy, from our shadow. We go into it. We use those very defilements to awaken. And so this is a big difference. In the early Buddhism, it was kind of like there are all these obscurations, greed, hate, delusion, and you want to eliminate them. Kind of like, So you have precepts. Like even the Theravada tradition, the monks have like 350 precepts. If you practice every one of these 350, that's the way to enlightenment. The Mahayana, the emphasis wasn't on that. It was almost like, oh, I've got some anger. Great. This is an opportunity for me to find out about myself, to work with this, to develop patience and understanding about other people that have anger. See the shift? There's a substantial shift there in terms of how you look at it. In the Lojong, number six slogan in the Lojongs is, which we're going to get to in a minute about skandhas. It says, three objects, three poisons, three seeds of virtue. So that's actually in some ways the heart of Buddhist philosophy. So the three objects are anything in the external world or thoughts. Those are also the objects. Anything that you relate to is like an object, sort of the external world. And when those things happen, what happens a million times a day or a thousand times a day is you have three responses to the objects. One is that you like it, that's nice. You don't like it, or you're neutral. Most of the time we're neutral. But usually we have a positive or sometimes a positive or negative. And this goes on again and again and again during the day. But then sometimes things really bug you. Like somebody honks at you on the freeway, or your car doesn't start, the battery goes dead. And then one of those dislikes really gets cranked up. So when it gets cranked up, when one of those positive, negative news gets cranked up, then it goes into the three poisons. And the three poisons are what turn the wheel of codependent origination. In the middle, there's the snake, the rooster, and the pig. They turn into greed, hate, and delusion. In other words, I really hate that. I really like, I've got to have it. Addictive. I've got to have it. Or just so confused you don't know. So the objects are first, and then the three poisons, which actually are many permutations of that. And then the other ones are the three seeds of virtue. And the three seeds of virtue in the original Buddhist teaching was, well, you just eliminate them. But in the Mahayana, it was like, oh, let's use these. The metaphor in Tibet, I just love this, is a peacock. Have you ever heard this? Because a peacock, I don't know if this is really true, but this is in Tibetan mythology, the peacock eats poison, can eat poisonous plants, and it doesn't bother them. And so the peacock is a metaphor for that kind of virtue. You eat your poison. In other words, That's how it's through eating and coming into relationship. Or sharing the slogan we did last night, which is exactly the same, right? Stay close to your resentments. In other words, find out where your resentments are and stay really close to them, not to perpetrate them, but to learn from them. That's another slogan, more towards the end. Stay close to your resentments. So that's what would be in Seeds of Virtue. Staying close to your resentments. So that's what a bodhisattva does. So the important thing in the sutra is to understand that this thing we call emptiness, which we'll talk more about, is the same as compassion. They go hand in hand. Because if you see that you're inseparable from everything that you touch, the natural result of that is compassion. Just like this hand intuitively has compassion for this hand, right? And this has compassion for your leg. Well, this is the extension of what the Heart Sutra is trying to do, is to get you to extend that sense of connectivity. So, in earlier Buddhism, as I've said, the word impermanence was maybe a little cool, and we'll talk about this again, but emptiness was more full, was a sense of fullness. Everything is an endless flowing in and out of each other, like I was saying, like water. When you look through this eye of compassion, all you see is the world of compassion. Everything flowing through each other. What Norman calls big love. Big love. So compassion arises in me not necessarily because of some desire or some emotion, because it is just the nature of reality itself. A flow and connection, a mingling of everything. Reality is nothing but the free-flowing of love. Reality is compassion. So that's a big step, right? To get to that point. Where even in the midst of pain, you see it in a very, very big picture. And so that's what Avalokiteshvara is. The Avalokiteshvara, who is hearing the cries of the world, sees the whole picture, the whole big picture, about how you can't separate anything out. Even those things, even at an absolute level, even those things which we think are, you know, bad. That's why it says in the sutra, like no, kind of no defiled, either pure or not pure. It's coming from that very big place. That's very, very hard for us to see that. Because we have to take, especially those of us that are involved and really interested in social justice, it'll be a march on Saturday, right? Both in Santa Rosa. Is it going to be one here? There'll be one in Santa Rosa and one in Oakland and one in Santa Rosa. I don't know if I'll make it to the one in San Francisco. This is against gun violence, right? So on one hand, you feel it, you have some response to it, and you act, but you also are able to hold it in a big picture. That's why, you know, when I would do jail counseling with people that were murderers, if all I focused on is what they did and who they hurt, I couldn't help them, right? So I had to relate to them from a place of how could a person do something like this, and that how could I see their greater potential than just that as an identity as a murderer, you know? So that's the only way you can, if you begin to relate to, so you can relate to both, right? On one hand, you could see why they needed to be in jail. They were a danger, they were needed to have some karmic repercussion, and they needed maybe to protect society. But on the other hand, you could relate to them, you know, with a sense of compassion and love. So we're called to do both, operate on kind of both levels. Is this a little bit clear what I'm saying? This is an important point. So we call this, in practice, the absolute and the relative. So on a relative level, Maybe you have to lock people up, you know? On another level, you can relate to them in the very big picture. And because most of us operate 95% of the time on the relative level, that's why the sutra is trying to give us this bigger perspective. And that's why our meditation practice, get pure presence ever transcending. Pure presence ever transcending. It gives you an experiential taste of what the big picture is. So maybe that, we've got to go faster than this. We'll be doing this for a year.